from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. When Bay Area psychologist Stephen Hinshaw was a child, his father would disappear for months on end without explanation. It was only later that he learned his dad struggled with bipolar disorder, and Hinshaw will join us in studio to discuss his new memoir, Another Kind of Madness, all about growing up in the shadow of unspoken trauma. We'll also hear why he thinks we urgently need to destigmatize mental illness. It's all coming up after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Scientists know a lot more today about mental illness than they did a generation ago, but UC Berkeley psychology professor Stephen Hinshaw says that social attitudes toward mental health issues have not kept up with the advances in research. Hinshaw joins us in studio this hour to discuss the urgent need to destigmatize mental illness so that more people can access the help that they need. We're also going to hear about his memoir, Another Kind of Madness, which explores his experience growing up with a mentally ill father whose illness was kept a secret for 18 years. And I welcome Stephen Hinshaw to the program. Welcome back to the program. Good to have you with us.
Well, thanks so much. It's great to be here always.
I guess the place to begin, I want to talk about your book first because it's really quite poignant and personal, and I know you put your whole soul into it. Begins in 1936, actually with something you didn't find out about until 1971 when your father kind of closed the door and told you about it. There's your dad, son of Quakers, hearing voices in his head and getting up on top of a roof and feeling he can fight fascism, make his contribution to the war effort, and do it essentially by the wings that he has to fly.
That's right.
Now, I mean, it's just a very dramatic story, obviously, but a story that you had not even a scintilla of understanding about. You didn't know what your dad was experiencing or what he had experienced, and this had been a pattern his whole life.
When my sister and I were quite young back in Ohio, the lead doctor, the lead psychiatrist, told my father clearly, if your children ever learn of your mental illness or your hospitalizations, they'll be permanently destroyed. You and your wife are forbidden from ever mentioning it. And my dad was always adherent to medical advice, and so until my first spring break from college, I lived in silence about the most important issues staring our family in the face. And it was, in some ways, an idyllic childhood. My father was a philosopher. My mom taught English at Ohio State, went to Ohio State football games. What could have been a better life except for the silent terror lurking underneath everyday experience? Dad would disappear for 3 or 6 or sometimes a year at a time, and no one was allowed to talk about it before he left, during the time he was gone. And some days in the kitchen, I'd look up and he was cooking breakfast again. And I thought, well, who had abducted him back? Because he must have been abducted by aliens sometime before. The silence and the mystery were just as much a part of my upbringing as the athletics and academics.
And you say in the book it necessitated play acting and performing on a kind of a constant basis. I mean, yeah. Your father would return and he wouldn't remember neighbors' names, and your mother had to kind of really cover for him, and everybody couldn't talk about this because this was the 50s and you didn't talk about it.
You didn't talk about it. As I write at one point in the book, it's kind of hard to imagine today an oncologist ordering a family never to talk about a parent's cancer. I mean, you'd think that's... How could that be? But that was the medical advice in the day, because mental illness was so frightening that it would, again, permanently destroy the children. So what kids tend to do when something's not going right in a family, nobody talks about it, is blame themselves.
Well, even cancer itself for a while was not spoken about.
That was not in the obituary, right? Yeah. That was a shameful disease you brought on yourself through weak personal will. Now it's a cause, because we can talk about it.
Well, it's become your cause in many ways. I mean, not only the ability and willingness to talk about and get this out of the secrecy, which is still very much with us in different guises and under different circumstances, but also to get away from the stigma of mental illness, because to some extent it has not made the kind of progress that many people might assume or hope.
No. The Pew report released recently between 2001 and 16 attitudes toward gay marriage in the United States have radically changed. But we don't have the same attitudinal change about mental health. In fact, three times more Americans than in the 50s automatically link mental illness with violence and aggression. Because it's a danger, your danger to self and others. That's how you get committed.
Or incompetence.
Or incompetence, that's right. And those are the main media portrayals still. So, inspired by my father's words, I became a child clinical and developmental psychologist and do research on causes and treatments. But now, as you just mentioned, the real mission is at hand. We've got to change the dialogue about being open about mental health. When it's part of the national dialogue, it can't be defunded the way it's been, and we can't deny the fact that access to treatment is nowhere near what it should be.
I'm talking to Stephen Henshaw, who actually has a missionary lineage. His grandmother was a missionary in Central America. He's the author of Another Kind of Madness, A Journey Through the Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness, professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, and professor of psychiatry also at UC San Francisco. And we should mention he'll be at Book Passage in Corte Madera on September 15th. That's long from now, but mark it down on your calendars. Your father is a fascinating figure, not only because obviously he was a charmer when he had his wits about him and very well liked, a man who actually studied with Bertrand Russell, no less, and knew Einstein, knew R.D. Lang, and was brilliant, clearly. But then suddenly the disappearances and the hospitalizations and the mania. I mean, actually, the original diagnosis was schizophrenia. And this happened with a lot of people who had bipolar disease. They'd be diagnosed as being schizophrenic, and it would turn out, of course, that they were bipolar.
That's
like
right.
Father,
you know? If you get sufficiently manic, delusions and hallucinations, hearing voices is often part of the picture. And for most of the 20th century in the U.S., if you had those symptoms, well, the default diagnosis was schizophrenia. But bipolar illness, either with severe manias or depressions, can, at those moments, mimic schizophrenia. And, well, does it matter? Does diagnosis matter? Well, we know that there are some more specific mood-stabilizing medications and forms of psychotherapy for bipolar illness that, if Dad would have benefited, he would have not been either non-treated or maltreated the way he was from age 16 until I diagnosed him correctly right out of college in his 50s.
Well, and as you say, you were inspired to go into the field to some extent by learning about what he had been through. And what he had been through was countered by this, when he returned to his rational, loving self, and suddenly, you know, you had your father back.
That's right.
I mean, the confusion of that for a child, you and your sister Sally, I mean, it must have been in some ways just overwhelming. And you had symptoms, and you must have also had terrible anxiety about, is this going to be passed down to me or to my sons?
Yeah, once my dad started to come out of the closet, so to speak, my freshman year of college, I now had a mission. I wanted to go into psychology and study mental health. But I was also terrified because I didn't go back east to Harvard and tell roommates or girlfriends or anybody for a few years until I was open enough to get support. And I thought, well, schizophrenia runs in families. Genes are responsible. We knew that by the 70s. So I'm probably next. If I don't stick on a pretty straight and narrow path, I might end up in a back ward the way Dad had in California and in Philadelphia when he was hospitalized right after he got his doctorate from Princeton, and many times at Columbus State Hospital. His older brother, Robert Bob, became a psychiatrist. He'd been the first out of the house in 36 to see his younger brother splayed on the sidewalk below the porch roof, and he would often fly to Columbus to sort of rescue his brother, get him on what they hoped were the right medications at the time. And when families experience severe mental illness, there's often many family members who are motivated to go into some of the mental health fields, and that's certainly my case, and it was the case for me and for my Uncle Bob as well.
But you also struggled. You struggled with depression. You struggled
right.
with eating troubles, so we say, or eating
I believe, well, of course, neurosis. I got migraines like the rest of my family, and vomiting's part of that. All the boys in the family would get them in their teens. And in college, I thought, boy, if I can't sleep through the night, I'll probably end up hearing voices. And so just at the way at the end of a migraine, the nausea would come involuntarily. Well, if I could make myself get this crud out of my system, maybe I could sleep. And so there's a lot of problems and impairments that emanate from mental illness. But Another Kind of Madness, the title of the book, comes from a James Baldwin quote from Giovanni's Room. And once I heard that quote, I thought, another kind of madness, worse than any form of mental illness, is stigma and shame. Because if you don't talk about it and you don't have access to care, that's actually worse than the symptoms of just about any form of mental illness. Because then there's no hope.
And Giovanni's Room is about gay identity as well as black identity.
That's right.
And you mentioned the fact that now we are much more accepting toward, for example, the same-sex marriage and gay and lesbian identity. We're also a lot more accepting toward left-handedness, as you point out
That's
in your
right.
book. I mean, there was a time when, you know, left was sinistre, the sinister idea of people who are left-handed.
And now, well, you go to MIT, you probably have good spatial skills. It's hardly stigmatized. But that gives hope, because as societies change their values and attitudes, formerly stigmatized traits can be far more accepted. Again, we know a lot more about mental health. Most Americans today can identify the symptoms of mania and schizophrenia and PTSD and ADHD, but our attitudes are far slower to equal our knowledge.
The stigmatization of mental illness, which you make the case, continues to go on. In fact, there are about maybe three times more today than there were back in the day when you were going through this who believe that mental illness is somehow associated with violence and incompetence and the kind of things that we were highlighting. But a big question, of course, is access to care. And a big question along with that is, in many people's minds, does the treatment really work? You know, they think about lying down on a couch and psychotherapy, and is this really going to get away from my parents' delusions or their manic states or their falling into depression? And there's a good deal of skepticism. There's also concern about psychotropics and Thorazine and all these kinds of drugs
right.
and their after effects. So where's the hope in this, particularly for you?
So here's the ultimate paradox. We don't have cures for mental health conditions yet, but evidence-based treatments, sometimes medications, sometimes forms of family or individual psychotherapy, often their combination, are actually more effective than most medical treatments for the medical conditions you go to see your doctor about. Not a cure, but coping and learning how to manage moods and gather emotion regulation skills. And that you need to, if you have psychotic disorders, stay on medications and often counter side effects. Talking with families so that kids don't stay mystified. These evidence-based forms of treatment really do work, but most people with mental health issues are ashamed to admit it, may not even know they've got the symptoms of a mental disorder. We don't have parity yet for mental health compared to physical health. And of course, at the federal level, what's happening with health care is in grave doubt right now. So it's a troubled time in many ways for ensuring health care, and mental health care remains on the back burner in all too many cases.
I think you point out that American Disabilities Act, only 5% of the claims are for mental disorders.
Well, it's another paradox. If you've got a mental health condition and under ADA want to get an accommodation, the accommodation might be an extra hour at lunch and stay at work an hour later, flex time, not the expense of building a ramp or widening a door, but people are too ashamed to file a suit under ADA for mental health conditions,
even
when the
though
fix
they
would
make
be
them,
easy.
They make them essentially physical and mental the same.
Exactly.
Of, yeah.
That's what the ADA says. You can't discriminate in the workplace or in public against a physical or a mental disability, but very few people file suit under ADA for mental health conditions.
Bipolar disorder, you also point out, has half of those with the disorder, and they're, you know, it's a whole continuum in terms of the intensity of it, but attempted suicide, and about, if untreated, a third of those actually do commit suicide.
That's right. So bipolar disorder, manic depression as it used to be called, still has a romanticized PR, if you will. Boy, if only I could be hypomanic, things would taste good, smell good, and look good, and I'd be hypersexual and creative and productive. That phase lasts just a short time in most people. Often manias progress into the very psychotic forms of mania my dad had. And then when the depressions hit at some point after, and when you've got the depressed mood and despair paired with the energy and perturbability of a mania, if you've got a negative affect floating around your head, it's really hard to let go of it. And it's that impulsivity paired with the despair that makes bipolar disorder a particularly lethal form of mental illness. And the romance is gone then, because it's, I mean, there's much more depression per se than bipolar, but case by case, bipolar disorder is a more lethal condition when you get those combinations of manias and depressions.
Yeah, I'm thinking about David Foster Wallace, who you may be familiar with, you know, a famed writer and a writer of great distinction, who had the privilege of interviewing a couple times, but he was so manic and, you know, said to a great extent that may have been the catalyst to a lot of his creativity and a lot of the work that he did. But when he would come down, he would come down so far. And here was the dilemma for him. He was taking medication, and the medication, his wife and others said, made him like a zombie.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he didn't have that vitality and everything. He wouldn't go into the depression or the delusion that was associated with the depression, so he gets off the medication and he commits suicide.
Well, it's a horrible dilemma sometimes. I mean, there's individual differences. Some people get on a mood stabilizing medication and it's day and night and the bipolar cycles are almost vanquished. For other people, there's breakthrough manias. Despite medication, the symptoms emerge. These medicines are often better at squelching manias than lifting depressions. You've got to fight it out with a doctor who knows the score and supplements medication with individual and often couples or family therapy. Therapy may not work when you're floridly manic and delusional, but in between episodes, getting coping skills for yourself and your loved ones can make a huge difference and often motivate people to stay on medications while the titration's being done.
Well, you indicated earlier that a lot of the problems we have with stigma go to the media and the way mental illness is presented in the media. There's a whole controversy, I'd just like your take on this, about the figure Carrie in Homeland, because on the one hand, clearly she's dealing with bipolar disorder, and that's a part of the whole script and what's presented in her character. Yet at the same time, you know, I know a number of psychiatrists who say this isn't the way bipolar disorder really works. You know, it's romanticized, it's TV. So there's maybe a breakthrough on the one hand, but kind of more illusion on the other? Or, I don't know, how do you see it?
Yeah, I mean, nobody with bipolar disorder is the same as anybody else. The same is true of cancer. The same is true of heart disease. I think it's a more realistic and subtle portrayal than many overly dramatic ones that have been on the media before. What we still don't have is enough everyday stories. You can be John Nash with schizophrenia and win the Nobel Prize in Economics for game theory, or you can be the raving person you see on walking down Market Street or Telegraph Ave asking for a handout, but not much in between. I think what's made breast cancer a cause, other forms of cancer causes, people's everyday coping. You're not necessarily a hero, you're certainly not a villain, but everyday triumphs, everyday stresses and coping, those are the daily narratives that have made cancer part of the national dialogue. For mental health, it's still either superhero or supervillain and not enough in between.
Well, you've got this group, this Let's Club, Let's Erase the Stigma,
right?
And reaching out to children, and you yourself as a child were harmed by this, I think it's safe to say, because you internalized a lot, took the blame in the way children often do, for your father's enigmatic behavior and his disappearances and so forth. Tell us about Let's.
So Let's is an acronym for Let's Erase the Stigma. Let's, it's now run by Bring Change to Mind, Glenn Close's organization that's fighting stigma on several fronts in college students and public service announcements and in high schools.
This is where you got to know Glenn Close?
That's right. She asked me. She cold called me a few springs ago. I've finished giving a lecture at Berkeley, got a 212 signal on my cell phone, and the caller said that it was Glenn Close calling for me. I thought it was a friend probably punking me, but it wasn't. It was Glenn, and she asked me to be on her scientific board. We spoke together, we're on the media together a bit, and she got very interested in if high school students, without a mental health counselor, now sometimes students need counseling and therapy, but you go to a club, the chess club, the rugby club, the Latin club, if there's any more Latin clubs, or the Let's Club. You go to Club Week, and this is a club with an advisor, a teacher, and not a script to teach the facts about mental illness, but a guidebook of activities, guest speakers, increasing empathy, talking to the principal, talking to the school board, talking to the city council. Kids' natural empathy and activism can get unleashed in these clubs. We just finished an evaluation of 50 schools, high schools in the Bay Area, some of which were assigned randomly to start their club early in the year, and some of which midway through the year, and we get evaluations at several points in the year. And we're just looking at the data now, as our pilot data in LA a few years ago. Kids who are part of these clubs know more about mental health, and their attitudes improve as a function of the club. Now, interestingly, with our recent data, the kids started off, before the clubs even began, with pretty good attitudes. Social media and alternative media are really changing kids' attitudes in ways that I think is promising for the future. But we think these clubs, again, without the label of being in treatment, but engendering social activism, may start to change the national dialogue. Attitudes consolidate in early to mid-adolescence. It's for people my age, it's late in the game, whether it's gay marriage or whether it's mental health attitudes. And Let's, and along with many other programs around the country, working with young people, I think, is the hope for the future.
We're talking with Stephen Hinshaw. He is the author of Another Kind of Madness, A Journey Through the Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness. And the other kind of madness is really the stigma.
That's right. Stigma is an ugly term. As I say in one passage in the book, just say it a couple times, stigma, the fricative stick in your throat. And some people contend we shouldn't use this term because itself is stigmatizing, as though people with mental health issues deserve to be one down. I agree to some extent prejudice and discrimination are part of this, but we still use the term racism because it exists. I don't think we just sweep it under the closet. The goal is, if there's discussion, if there's changed attitudes, if it's part of this regional and national and international dialogue, and many countries are coming on board with this, it can't be swept under the rug any longer.
And again, I want to remind listeners that Stephen Hinshaw is professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, also professor of psychiatry at UC San Francisco. And this is an opportunity for you to join us. I know many of you probably have been affected by the stigma of mental illness, if not personally, within your family, or have seen it affect friends and loved ones, or even just acquaintances. And you may want to indeed let us know what your story is, because as Professor Hinshaw makes rather dramatic in his book, stories are what's important here and what does change attitudes. And I think that's certainly true as far as stigmas. But stigmas also breed shame and silence, and they are perhaps another kind of madness. And you may indeed want to weigh in here. There are, I should say, just statistically for the record, three times more cases of bipolar now than schizophrenia, even though in Stephen's own story, it was his father who was diagnosed for years as schizophrenic, and that was true for many who were suffering from what later became called bipolar disorder, what was called manic depression. We invite you to join the program. You can do that now, toll free. The number to call, 866-733-6786. We welcome your calls. Any questions or comments, stories, join us now, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, and join the program that way, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or go to our Facebook page. But we do welcome your involvement and hope you'll join us. Has your life been affected by the stigma of mental illness? Let's hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending this hour with Professor Stephen Hinshaw, who's the author of a memoir, His Own Experiences, Another Kind of Madness, A Journey Through the Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness. His father suffered from mental illness, and the whole family suffered as a result, even though by all his own accounts, certainly his father was an extraordinarily loving and giving man. And Stephen Hinshaw is a professor of psychology at UC Berkeley, a professor of psychiatry at UC San Francisco. And here's Kathy, who writes, one of the greatest things my mother did for our family way back in the mid-1970s, after my brother was diagnosed with mental illness, was to say to the rest of our family that it was just a disease and we were going to talk about it. Not everyone understood, but it opened up a world to me that there is no shame in mental illness, that the brain is just another system, and systems get sick. I'm forever grateful to my mother for this. Shannon writes, this is hitting home. My mother was bipolar, and tomorrow is 11 years since her suicide. Let me go to our callers, and I'll do that in just a second. But you want to comment on any of those comments?
My colleague, Bill Beardsley of Harvard Medical School, former chief of child psychiatry at Children's Hospital Boston, invented a form of family therapy some years back. in cases where one or both parents has either depression or bipolar disorder. Now, the parents need sometimes medication, sometimes individual therapy for themselves, but the family therapy is intended to get the parents to talk with their kids about what's going on at home, because kids know something's going on. Now, this doesn't mean kids are exposed to terribly disorganized behavior. We don't want to traumatize kids. But when this dialogue ensues and parents resist and the therapist works with the parents when the kids are out of the room for a while to rehearse and explains in everyday language about dad's drinking or mom's absences or whatever it is, not only do the kids do better after 16 weeks of this therapy, but 4 years later, their own risk of becoming depressed is cut in half. Genes transmit depression, and especially bipolar disorder, but communication is part of the transmission process too. And I think the first writer's mother was quite intuitive back in the 70s. It's an illness like any other. Now, it's a little unlike others because the organs in the brain and behaviors and emotions are quite salient. But if kids can have some understanding in the family's own words, often with therapeutic guidance, they won't blame themselves and internalize.
Which is what happened to you.
Absolutely.
And that's part of your story here and part of what is compelling. But how do you get away from, I mean, even if you're opening things up, the fear of heritability? I mean, because I know it afflicts so many people at a young age when they do find out.
That's right. So we know that.
It's a real fear. Yeah.
It's a real fear. But statistics cut both ways. If you've got a first-degree relative, like a parent with bipolar disorder, your own risk is increased. But the vast majority of people with one parent with bipolar disorder do not develop bipolar disorder. So it's our concept of relative risk versus absolute risk. It's interesting, though, also that some of the most successful people in every society are the first degree relatives of people with bipolar disorder. I mean, this is inaccurate, but pretend it takes 30 genetic variants or alleles to be in a certain configuration for bipolar disorder. And let's say you've got 8 or 10 or 12 of them. Maybe you're a little more productive and creative, and maybe you've got some energy surges that don't go into full-blown mania. Entrepreneurs, artists, professionals, professors, many are overrepresented in those professions among the first-degree relatives of people with bipolar disorder. Maybe that's why something like bipolar exists generation after generation in the gene pool, because some of the partial risk is an enhancer. So it's not all or none. It's not just bad genes. It's a mixed blessing in many cases.
Well, and as we learned in so many instances and under so many different umbrellas, nature and nurture work in mysterious ways together. Let me bring some callers into this, and we start, Kate, with you. You're on the air.
Hi, my name is Kate Crosby. I'm 35 years old, and I'm bipolar. I think that one of the things that we really need to look at because I have a service dog, and he helps me a lot.
The call is breaking up here, Kate, I'm sorry to say. If you could call back, we would like to get you on. And let me go to another caller in the meantime. This is Sridhar from Berkeley. Sridhar, welcome.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. And thank you for your guest. My wife and I, we have been married for 10 years, and she has a problem with obsessive compulsive disorder. She her symptoms seem to be getting worse and worse every day, and my kids are 2 and 4. So this discussion really struck a chord with me. So I just wanted to understand. I keep talking to the kids about this, but I don't really know how to exactly discuss it with the kids to make them understand.
Let's get some advice from Stephen Hinshaw here. His wife has this disorder. They have kids. What's the best tack for him to take?
So I would really think about finding someone who does some family therapy to help the parents talk with the kids about what's going on. It's hard for people to find their own words to
do. It's also hard for people to find a really good therapist.
It's hard to do that, too, and the internet can help with that. But again, you don't want to expose or traumatize kids to really difficult situations, but you also don't want kids to wait in silence for the next shoe to drop or to, you think, well, why would a kid blame himself or herself? It's probably better in some ways than just believing the world's a cruel random place. At least there's some control and some dialogue, some understanding about illness, brains, whether there's hospitals, getting treatment, hope with treatment. Those are the kinds of things that kids can understand about cancer, about mental health issues.
Let me thank the caller. We'll go to more calls in just a moment. I want to read a comment from Diane, who says, "Our parents forbade us to talk about my brother's mental health. It shattered our childhood. I became a psychotherapist in retirement to help others." Here's Gerald, who writes, "I'm a little tired of people asking why mental illness and its medications can't be treated like diabetes and insulin. I write as someone who has both. I still feel and expect other people to feel, rightfully or not, that diabetes is something I have, but mental illness is something wrong with me. We are much harder on someone with an ugly face than someone with an ugly house."
Wow. Eloquently put. Again, cancer afflicts various organ systems. Mental health issues affect the brain and mind, and so the symptoms are part of your personality, and we tend to say, well, it must be your fault. You didn't have right character. And of course, for most of the 20th century, the cause of mental illness was thought to be bad parenting. We know that genes play a significant role in many forms of mental illness. Parents are typically not to blame, but there's responsibility for getting treatment, but that's why we need better mental health care too. It's going to take a lot of levels. Parity of healthcare insurance, media change, getting open dialogue, telling stories rather than just statistics to start to move the dial on stigma.
What do we do about lessening the social stigma when there is a lot of social fear attached? Even people who are enlightened, even people who say, look, you know, mental illness is just another illness.
Right.
It ought to be seen like the Affordable Care Act has in the context of illnesses and so forth. But you see someone who's acting ultramanic, let's say, or you see,
right.
and it evokes fear.
It's threatening. This is one of the social
menacing, even,
psychological
yeah.
theories of why these behaviors are so stigmatized. It's there, but for the grace of God go I, and maybe I work hard every day to keep stable, and maybe I'm not as stable as I thought because here's somebody hearing voices or acting in very irrational ways. There may be some evolutionary roots to this, too. We don't want to catch a disease that somebody has, especially if it's a disease of the mind and behavior. But people with treatment can get better. That's what the facts are that need to be taught. Mental health treatments, as we talked in the first segment, are as effective, if not more, than most medical treatments for medical disorders. If people can get access to care, if evidence-based treatments are taught in psychology and medical and social work programs, and if people, and here's a shocking statistic, people with serious mental illness wait an average of 10 years before recognizing symptoms and getting an assessment or treatment. That's a decade of life that is stigmas to blame for. And earlier treatment is going to help thwart the course of this. It's all part of the same picture.
I also came across recently another kind of shocking statistics. That's patients with dementia die earlier if the caregivers are mentally stressed.
That's right. So my colleague Bob Levinson at UC Berkeley and his team of students and postdocs paired up with UCSF are really working hard on this caregiver issue with dementia. And stress levels for dementia caregivers are enormous, as they are for people who are caring for a relative with serious forms of mental illness. My mother, who was part of the shame and silence, she wasn't allowed to tell my sister and me. The therapist would never talk to her because it was my dad's issues and was confidential. She kept the family together. There's a passage in the book. I didn't know it at the time. When I was 4 and my sister was 3, Dad was watching the big black and white TV down in the living room in Columbus with his wife, my mother, one night, and he thought the singer in a sequin dress was singing directly to him and had to get in the car and drive 100 miles to Cincinnati before freeways at 90 miles an hour to find the singer before the station closed. My mother had an instant choice to make, go with him, but leave the kids or maybe never see him again. These are the impossible situations that caregivers need support around.
Hey, your mother comes off heroic. Really,
she was.
Nothing less than heroic. Let me bring another caller here, and that's Becky. Becky, you're on.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Henshaw. I have a question for you. Also, I thank you so much for speaking about the need for insurance. I have a 14-year-old daughter. Actually, we are her legal guardian, have been since she was 4, and we're paying for all the treatment out of hand. We're both retired. And so I hope that this kind of thing will get people to pay more attention to mental illness. But my question to you is, we got her when she was 4, and she had a lot of trauma, early trauma. And initially they diagnosed her as PTSD, but now they're saying bipolar or personality disorder. And I just wanted your opinion on the effects of trauma to a young child and how that can affect these mental illnesses.
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked. So trauma, physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, these forms of maltreatment are traumatizing forms of psychological triggers for many problems, both concurrently and later on. What's really fascinating and really shows the need for treatment is that for a condition like bipolar disorder, for which genes explain most of the risk, the heritability is 80 to 85%. But if you've got the genetic risk and you've received trauma, as my dad did, his stepmother physically abused him when he was a boy, then cycles tend to begin earlier and they're harder to treat. Genes and environments, as Michael mentioned a few minutes ago, work together in exquisite and sometimes troubling ways. We know this is true for some of the research I do on kids with ADHD and our large study of girls with ADHD. Very heritable condition. But if girls with ADHD are traumatized in their first 10 years of life, their risk of attempting suicide goes above 35%. Genes and environments work together. Now, of course, I can't diagnose your 14-year-old over the airwaves. My guess is that the early trauma and probably some genetic risk have combined together to yield some really difficult problems with mood regulation, now getting potentially branded as bipolar disorder or borderline features. And evidence-based treatment like dialectical behavior therapy, DBT, is really important for early signs of suicidality and borderline personality disorder. And I hope, and of course, paying for treatments is a big issue, but I hope you can get her the care she needs.
Could you say something more what DBT is?
So DBT, invented by Marsha Linehan, our colleague up at University of Washington, is this paradox. It's like a dialectic, like Hegel and Marxism, right? There's a lot of acceptance of your emotional states, but also the therapist sets clear limits too. And you're trying as hard as you can, but you've got to try harder.
So you got thesis, antithesis, and then you work out a synthesis.
Synthesis. And it's borderline personality disorder has long been stigmatized even in the mental health fields. This is the condition you don't want, and therapists give up on these manipulative patients. DBT gives a lot of hope through a very structured dialectical program, and there can be meditation and awareness and other forms of support. Phone calls are permissible outside therapy hours, and the evidence shows that this can really help.
Even with borderline?
Even with borderline personality disorder, yeah.
Let me go to more of our callers. But first, I just want to mention, because we've been talking a lot about stigma, that I guess there's been some canvassing of Americans on this, and it may even be true across the Atlantic. The lowest forms of stigma are attached to homeless people and people who are drugging, substance abuse and mental illness.
See,
I mean, they're all kind of right down at the top.
Yeah, top or bottom, depending on how you look at it. They're the bottom three of public acceptance. Are you homeless, threatening substance? You've got control over putting that stuff in your mouth or in your veins. And mental illness still thought to be caused exclusively by families or by weak moral fiber. And
also all associated with violence, too.
That's
and dangers,
right.
And, yeah.
I mean, the fact is that people with serious forms of mental illness are 5 times more likely to be victimized by violence than everybody else. Yes, if you're delusional and believe someone's out to control you, violence can be part of the picture of some psychotic illnesses. With treatment, that goes back to baseline, and the vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent. So these are some of the stereotypes that we need to quash at the same time.
Again, we're talking to Stephen Hinshaw, and his book is called Another Kind of Madness, A Journey Through the Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness. And Patty, join us, Patty. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I wanted to thank you, Dr. Hinshaw, for talking in length about the stigma and how we can start breaking it. I have bipolar disorder. I'm 57 years old, and I am so fortunate to have gone through treatment, been stable, for 14 years. what I was finding when I was trying to find some information and coping mechanisms, there weren't anything out there to tell about the middle story. It was, you know, celebrities with, you know, unfortunately extreme symptoms, or it was, you know, stories about people with PTSD, excuse me. And I am that middle story.
Yeah.
And I do want to kind of be a help to able to tell that story. I don't know if you're gathering information to help destigmatize.
Well, that's terrific. I mean, send me an email, hinshaw@berkeley.edu. Google me and you'll find other ways of accessing me. The National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI, is a great group that there's a program called IOOV, In Our Own Voice, where people like you speak to groups of dentists and lawyers and kids and everybody else to share the stories. These are the everyday tales of heroism and coping and sometimes mini despair that if we get, again, these part of the national dialogue, we don't have to rely on the superheroes and supervillains. And so bless you for calling, and I hope you can make contact with me and some of these other groups and share your story.
And thank you for the call, indeed. And let me get another caller on. Sheila, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I just caught the last bit of the last caller. I'm not sure if she was talking about a similar thing around stigma, but I want to just thank you for emphasizing the point around stigmas. And I grew up in a family where there were secrets that were held and still are held today around my father and family members on both sides of the family about their mental illness. And only until I got sick in my 20s did a therapist ask me to go and look up my family history and go ask my mother, you know, what was going on with my father. And even then, she didn't want to believe that there was such a thing as mental illness. And it was generational. But I have to say, you know, I'm in my 50s and have done a lot of work to get healthy and, you know, manage my own mental illness. But I still have my own stigma. I'm not giving you my real name. I cannot tell employers if I need to take time off for the real reasons. I have to lie. Should even HR find out why I am sick and need to take a leave? It's only happened a couple times, but I can't rely on the fact that they would hold that as a private information should it get passed around. I would not get hired back, or it could damage my reputation at work. Those kinds of things really exist. And so I guess I'm ultimately saying thank you for raising the issue of stigma. And if you're a parent out there who has any of this in the family, I, you know, whatever the words are, it doesn't really matter. I think it's better to have an open conversation than keep it a secret, because it has long-term effects on shame.
Yeah.
Let me, Sheila, sort of dovetail off that and going to Professor Hinshaw. I mean, we've been talking a lot about overcoming the shame and the stigma at home, but what about the workplace? I mean, she's brought that up, and how do you see it?
Well, I mean, first of all, Sheila, this is the shameful legacy of skeletons in the closet that shouldn't exist in 2017 and still does. Under the Americans with Disabilities Act, signed by George Bush, one president back in 1990, the stigma against and discrimination against physical and mental disabilities in the public and in the workplace are law of the land. You can't do that. And depending on where you work and how big the HR group is, et cetera, if it's documented that you have a disorder,
there's legal protection.
There's legal protection.
But she's talking about the personal sense. I'm going to be perceived, and, you know, people are going to think less of me. And
that's right.
They're going to have these stereotype attitudes and so forth. I mean, that's a real problem.
It's a real problem, and I'm not advocating that people with mental health conditions and themselves or their family members go out with placards and disclose wantonly all the time. It's a matter of timing. It's a matter of trust. It's a matter of confidence and rehearsing and choosing one's battles. But if everybody keeps silent about it, then we can't make the change we need to. So this is a personal decision, a family decision for every particular case. But I hope there's ways and support groups. Again, NAMI and many other groups like it are fora, and here we are on forum, right, to tell your stories with other people like you and in similar situations. And a part of the mission of these advocacy groups is to help advocate and make the shame go away at a larger level.
You have three sons, right?
Yes, that's
right. And you told your story to your sons growing up?
Well, with our oldest, now 30, down in San Diego, and he knew his grandfather for a few years. And tried to think, can't do it the same way. How do you explain bipolar disorder? So I'm back in the day with Jeff. I said, imagine the happiest you've ever been. Magnify that by 10 or 20 times. Saddest you've ever been, and magnify that too. And might give us sort of a sense of what mania feels like or depression feels like. I don't know that there's no script. I don't know that any particular words I said or any parent says change the dial automatically. But the fact it's okay to talk about, and then there's questions and dialogue, that's the message, because it's not a secret anymore.
Here's Vicky, who writes, thank you for shining a light on this topic. I'm an adult child of a diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic father. As kids, we were told that daddy was sick, but that people didn't understand mental illness, so we were told to not talk about it outside the family. My father would be hospitalized for months at a time, and we were allowed to visit. To this day, I've told few friends about the illness, about his illness, fearing that I would be treated differently. I'm fairly sure that my three siblings feel the same.
Yeah. I mean, these are the stories, I think, everywhere, not just in the United States, but around the world. Well, wouldn't Asian cultures, more collectivists, have a different attitude? Well, marriage and arranged marriage, if there's the taint of someone with mental illness. Stigma knows no cultural boundaries, unfortunately. This is an issue east and west, north and south.
Also knows no class boundaries, of course. Either.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And here's Evan. Evan, join us.
Hi, good morning. I am an alcoholic in recovery, and before getting sober, I had a pre-diagnosis of bipolar 2, and a lot of those symptoms were a result of my substance abuse. And I live, thankfully, very openly with my employer and on social media about my recovery, and I'm really involved in the recovery community, and sometimes I can take it for granted. And occasionally, as in recently, I saw a video online, and the anger and vitriol from some areas, it comes as a surprise, you know, to me, and that the stigma is very real. So I just wanted to hear your comments on that and say thank you for approaching the topic.
Well, thank you. And let me just say a couple of things for listeners who may not know. Bipolar type 2, what does that mean? These are people with bipolar illness who, even without treatment, have the manias that kind of stop at hypomania, don't go into stages 2 and 3 as my father did, and those are intermixed with depressions. Bipolar type 1 with the full manias, type 2 with the hypomanias, is often comorbid with, to use the fancy term, substance abuse disorders, sort of dampening down with alcohol the flames of the mania or lifting up the depression. And so now you get need for treatment for the substance use part of it and for the bipolar part of it, but also, unfortunately, as I think you're pointing out, the double stigma as well.
And we thank you for the call, Evan. Let me bring another caller on here while we have a few moments. Christina joins us from Hayward. Christina, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to thank you for bringing these issues in and really just corroborate from my own personal experience a lot of what you've said. There is bipolar on both sides of my family, and there was a big, there wasn't necessarily a stigma around it. It was really talked about, but it was talked about in such a way that there was a lot of fear created around it, so that us as children really feared growing up and becoming bipolar, and that was something that was pretty pervasive. And my brother did, in fact, develop the disease. And just sort of conversely, on my husband's side of the family, there's some pretty severe mental illness that wasn't talked about at all, and that sense of shame really developed for him around not really understanding what was going on with his father, who was deeply depressed for most of his life. And similar to what you said, I myself became a family therapist, and it's something that I continue to see throughout my work. And it is so important to talk to your kids about it, but also to talk to them about it in a way that doesn't create fear and doesn't create this sense of, oh, God, what if I develop this horrible disease? Even if it has ravaged the lives of some family members who have had it, just to really understand the advancements that have been made and really learn to understand the diseases yourself as a parent.
Yeah, Christina,
it really has impacted. Yeah,
I thank you for that. And actually, we're running short of time here. I want to ask Dr. Hinshaw, how can you tell your kids or your family or your friends without fear taking over?
Well, I think you need practice. Family therapy, like Beardsley's therapy, is a really important way to do this. You've got to feel comfortable doing it, and you've got to do it and then get a dialogue going. Kids will give you feedback on what they understand and don't understand.
Appreciate very much your being with us. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
And again, Stephen Hinshaw's book is Another Kind of Madness, A Journey Through Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness, The Stigma and Hope of Mental Illness. Professor of Psychology at UC Berkeley and Professor of Psychiatry at UC San Francisco. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. Tomorrow, in our opening hour, we're going to be doing a joint broadcast with Cleveland Public Radio. We're going to be talking about police reform, and you're going to hear, obviously, from a different city how they're dealing with it, and they're going to hear how we're trying to deal with it here. Hope you will join us for that. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. And for all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.